This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present A Long Way From Home by Peter Carey. Narrated by Craig Baldwin, Saskia Marlveld, and Colin McPhillamy. Part 1. Bacchus Marsh, 33 miles from Melbourne.
Chapter 1. For a girl to defeat one father is a challenge. But there were two standing between me and what I wanted, which was, not to fiddle-faddle, a lovely little fellow named Titch Bobs. The first father was my own. When he discovered that I, his teeny Irene, his little mouse, his petite-sized mademoiselle, had, all by herself, proposed matrimony to a man of 5'3", he spat his Wheaties in his plate. Titch's father was number two. He came out of the gate at a gallop, 100% in favour. I was a beauty, a bobby dazzler, until in the hallway by the coat stand, he gave me cause to slap his face. My sister was older and more experienced. She could not see why I would want so small a husband. Did I plan to breed a team of mice? Ha, bloody ha. Beverly was 5'2½, and always breaking off engagements to Lanky Lurch or Gigantic Dino, or the famous football player whose name I am not ignorant enough to mention. I would have been afraid to shake his hand. Forget the other business. Beverly made her bed, and got what you might expect, i.e., 30-hour labours and heads as big as pumpkins. My own children were as tiny and perfect as their daddy, ideal in their proportions, in the lovely coordination of their limbs, in the pink, apply cheeks they inherited from Titch, the smile they got from me. My sister could not abide my happiness. She would spend hours looking for evidence that it was fake. When the first husband ran away to New Zealand, she wrote me a spiteful letter saying I was more interested in my husband than in my kiddies. She said her boys were everything to her. She knew, she wrote, I only married Titch because of the money I could get from him. She was upset, of course. Why wouldn't she be? She had married a bastard. She was divorced without a penny, so could she please go and live in the childhood home we had both inherited, and whose sale she had always managed to impede? Could Titch and I have used the money? She didn't ask. Would it have changed our lives? Of course. I agreed on a peppercorn rent and kept my feelings to myself. Beverly liked to say that I was willful, which was an idea she had got from Mum. But Mum liked me being willful. She got a real kick from seeing how I got my way. Of course, she was a bit the same, Mum, and she was blessed with such neat, level teeth and cheekbones. You would do anything to see her smile, even if you had to buy her a washing machine to make her do it. She got Dad to purchase the Ford, which was what brought Titch to our door in Geelong, Victoria, Australia. It was Victory in Europe Day, May 8th, 1945. No one will ever know how Mum planned to utilize the Ford. Drive down to Colac and see her sister after church? That was one story not even Dad could swallow. Didn't matter. He went on and wrote the check to the salesman, Dan Bobst, who, as I discovered when I opened the front door on VE Day, had thrown in free driving lessons, which would be supplied by his sonny. Oh, Lord, what a sight that sonny was, there on our front porch with his cardboard suitcase on a Tuesday morning. I learned he was to stay with us. Poor Mum. Alas, she never got to put the key in the ignition. And everyone was so upset and busy with the funeral, no one told the young man that he should leave. He had nowhere else to stay, so he unpacked his port and awaited instructions, as he later liked to say. The Ford was parked in our drive, with no sign that it was now part of the deceased estate. My mum was in the Mount Dunead Cemetery, and the new boarder was the only one who helped me go through her things. He said nothing about the car, or about the lessons he had been expecting to give the deceased. He asked me if I knew how to drive. I told him that if he could be home by 6 at night, he could have tea with us. In the midst of all the sadness, this pretty red-cheeked man was a great comfort I could not do without. I held my breath. I cooked for him, and he scraped his plate clean and helped me with the drying up. He was neat. When I cried, he comforted me. He left talcum powder on the bathroom floor. In the nights at Western Beach, when you could hear the forlorn anchor chains of the old warships anchored in Corio Bay, he told me stories of his father, which he thought were funny. These were more important than I knew. In any case, my eyes stung hot to hear that the lovely boy had broken his arm, swinging the prop of the Richard father's monoplane, and that the old bully had taught him to land by sitting him in the navigator's seat and thumping his slender back with his fist until he pushed the stick down sufficiently, that he abandoned him to stay with a pair of old Irish bachelors at Ballengarook until they had learned to drive their purchase. The sonny was named Titch, although he was sometimes Zack, which was what they called a sixpence, and a Zack was therefore half a shilling, or half a bob, which was, of course, his father's name. Forget it. He was always Titch, God Jesus, and it seemed I was put on earth to love your tortured body and your impy, joyous soul. How could I predict, dear Beverly, what sort of life my heart's desire would lead me to? Our dad was still alive on the day I first set eyes on Titch. My babies were not yet born. I couldn't drive a car. We had not yet arrived at the era of Holden versus Ford. There was not even a Reddix around Australia reliability trial, although that, the greatest Australian car race of the century, is the story I will get to in the end. I was married the same day I got my driving license. I drove us 100 miles to Warragul myself. After that, we moved to Sale, then Burnsdale, and Titch sold Fords for his father, who always short-changed him on commission. My new husband was ideal in almost every way, and I knew that even before I understood his genius, which was the last thing you'd look for in a car salesman. He did not know how to lie, or so it seemed. He never exaggerated, unless to make a joke. He was funny, he was cheeky. He told me he had perfected the art of not being hit, which was just as well, seeing the bars he did business in. We lived in boarding houses and rented rooms and ate whole flocks of mutton. But incredibly, we were happy, even if his dad was in the room next door. Sometimes we made ourselves sick with laughing, rolling around the carpet on a Sunday afternoon. That should have been enough for anyone. My father-in-law was always lurking. I did not tell Titch the disgusting things he had suggested to me. He never heard them, thank the Lord. Nor did my husband seem to notice the insults against himself. Dan Bobbs was not a handsome fellow, but he preened with his comb so constantly he finally lost his hair. Titch was blind to the vanity. He would sit and listen as the scoundrel bragged endlessly about his exploits. I endured all this for years, until the old man found a Melbourne woman who would tolerate him. When he announced his retirement in the Wagga Express, I did not dare believe it. Dan had a lifetime of cuttings in his scrapbook. He had the first pilot's license in Australia. He had flown planes and got reported when he crashed them. He had raced Fords from Melbourne to Sydney. He had sold cars from farm to farm in the muddy dairy district of Gippsland and flat volcanic plains of Sunbury, where he did business in the old-school style. That is, left his son behind to give the driving lessons. Was he giving up the game? Or was this retirement just another chance to be written up? Edith was already 7. Ronnie had just been born. I tucked him in his pram so I could help shift his grandfather's possessions into his trailer. Ronnie woke up dirty and hungry, but I would not go to him until I had lashed a tarpaulin over Dan's oily junk. Even then I waited, watching that red tail light turn the corner by the lodge. Soon we had a postcard from Mrs. Donaldson, who introduced herself as the old man's housekeeper. Then there came an envelope containing a clipping from the Mordialloc Advertiser. He had set himself up as a scrap dealer. Mrs. Donaldson said they had a grand backyard. Danny had put a sign over the front gate. The oldest airman in the world. He sold war disposals and the occasional used car. He made another sign. If you can't find it here, it doesn't exist on Earth. A photograph was delivered. We saw he had modified the front veranda, so it was now held up by airplane propellers. Aviator retires to Wattle Street. Dan would never ask us direct for money. He would instead turn up with, say, a water pump for a 46 Ford. Titch did not need it, but I could never get him to refuse his dad. Beverly would say I always got my own way, but it was Beverly who got her way, refusing to get a job or budge from our Geelong house. There was enough money locked up there to start a dealership, but Titch never questioned me, never argued, never insisted. When Dan had left us to bully Mrs. Donaldson, I found a property for rent in Bacchus Marsh, a small town in a rural district Titch was long familiar with. Titch had hopes to build up a used car business so we could finally be Ford dealers. I chose the house with this in mind. It had a huge yard and a big shed spanning the width of the back fence. Titch was tickled pink. You could say that's where the story starts, at the site of our planned business, observed by the next-door neighbour, a fair-haired bachelor with a strong jaw and absent bottom, cinched in trousers, crumply face, deep frown marks on his forehead. He found me in my overalls with a spanner in my hand. Himself, he held a colander, some sort of gift. And I saw the sad, fond way he had with the kids, and I thought it might be a bad idea to be too kind to him. For everything in life begins with kindness. We had no plan to take advantage of him.
Chapter 2. Mrs. Bobbs didn't know the first thing about me. For instance, that I was a chalk and talker, recently suspended for hanging a troublesome student out of a classroom window. She didn't know that I was sought by bailiffs, that I was a regular on Deasy's radio quiz show, where my winnings were publicly announced each week. She didn't know that I was a mess of carnal yearning and remorse, that my small weatherboard house was now legally a fire hazard, its floors and tables crammed with books and papers. A putative visitor would be compelled to travel crabwise down the hallway, between the illegal bookshelves from front door to the sink. The kitchen table was a catastrophe, piled high with damp washing and academic quarterlies and musty pulp novels featuring Detective Inspector Napoleon Bonaparte, Boney, of the Queensland Police Force. "Oh, a bookworm," she would later say. I spent my entire life in Australia with the conviction that it was a mistake, that my correct place was elsewhere, located on a map with German names. I had lived with the expectation that something spectacular would happen to me, or would arrive, deus ex machina, and I was, in this sense, like a man crouched on a lonely platform, ready to spring aboard a speeding train. I had run away from Adelaide when I should have stayed home in the parsonage. I had married when I would have been happier single. I had fled my wife's adultery, left the only job that ever suited me, and come to Bacchus Marsh to teach the notorious second form. And still I waited for my salvation. Like the pastor's son I was, with an impatience that made my toes squirm inside my thirsty shoes. I had certainly been anticipating my new neighbours, although I could not have imagined anything like this. The night before had been filled with awful portent. A horse float was driven past my bedroom window, and two human figures then appeared. I rolled on my side, waiting for the horse to show its face, but when the doors were opened, nothing was revealed but kitchen chairs. I drifted back to sleep and dreamed. In that other world I saw the doors of the float now quilted and studded like a banquette. These swung slowly open, and I saw a man and boy carry out a mattress. They staggered down the ramp, and I was slow to understand their unsteadiness was not caused by their burden, but by laughter. I was sound asleep. I smiled as they danced out into the yard. They got just past the outhouse where they dropped their comic cargo beneath the walnut tree. It was only then I got the joke, which was, the mattress was not a mattress. It was a huge, fat snake, whiskery like a catfish, neatly folded up for travelling, wound round itself like a pastry snail. The man and boy uncoiled the serpent as if they were volunteer firefighters, laying a canvas fire hose down the centre of Main Street. Then the man charged ahead into the house, holding the placid snake's head beneath his arm. Although this man was not Mr. Deasy from the radio quiz show, he had a similar military moustache. The boy tottered helplessly behind him, holding what he could, until he collapsed onto the floor, rolling as if tickled. For several years I had paid attention to my dreams, and I judged this is a very positive specimen. I thought, while still asleep, that there was a time when snakes had feathers. I woke filled with light and happiness, which was not ruined when I heard my complaining hens gathered outside my door. I was sorry they had been bred to be so stupid. I was sorry to keep the poor creatures waiting. I made it up to them, putting together a special treat, a pollard mix, bran, cod liver oil, and added a good 2 bob's worth of cow's milk, stirring with my hand in the bucket. I washed. I opened the back door to find the rooster on the step. The hens must be fed first. The rooster knew that. It was his own principle, and he knew why I had to kick him across the yard. Sex is everywhere, most particularly when you have escaped it. As I watched the chooks eat, I became aware of the fuss next door, living children running through the previously abandoned house. I was in pyjamas. My feet were bare and the earth was cold. The horse float had disappeared. An extraordinary vehicle was now parked inside the cavernous, open-sided shed. I didn't rush at my neighbours like a lunatic. I dressed as normal, in checked tweed, gardening clothes and gumboots. I bumped the wheelbarrow off the front veranda and trundled out onto the street to collect whatever cow manure had been dropped by the beasts on their way to the sale yards. Back home, I cut a cauliflower. I collected what eggs my hens had laid for me. I took in my belt another notch. I washed the eggs and placed them in the remnants of my marriage, a chipped, enameled colander. I would not deliver this gift like a stranger by walking down the driveway. Instead, I used the vine-entangled gate in the side fence, a monument to the old friendship between a barber, whose estate owned my house, and the panel beater who'd become a landlord. I was startled to confront a miniature boy and girl playing amongst the wild mint. They'd found a fresh hen's egg, evidence my chooks were in the habit of trespassing. Perhaps I spoke to them, perhaps not. I turned to the former panel beater's open-sided shed, a pavilion, really, stretched across the back of the property. There, wrapped in shadow, was the vehicle, a 2-tone Ford Custom Line. Of course, I didn't know the brand quite yet, but it was so new and shiny that it contained an entire sky, towering white cumulus in its bulbous fenders. I could hear the voices of a man and woman, also the song of cooling metal. Hang on, no, the other one. They might have been doing the dishes, she washing, he drying, at the kitchen sink. I was drawn inevitably towards the automobile. I called first good morning and then cooey, and then I was inside the shed, which had become the home of pigeons with alarming wings. Then came another awful noise, like a filing cabinet dragged across a concrete floor, and there they were, shooting out from under the Ford. The astonishing pair, clad in faded coveralls, lying flat on mechanics' trolleys, icons with bright silver spanners in their hands. Mister must have been 5'2", and she even smaller. Missus's hair was so tousled and curling, she might have been, had not all the other evidence been so much to the contrary, a boy. Her husband's complexion was smooth and glowing. He could have been a girl. Yet to talk of boys and girls is to miss the point. The new arrivals stared at me, and I somehow understood that they, being visions, were not required to speak. "I am Willie Buckhuber," I said, for the war was less than 10 years over, and it was best to get the German business finished with at once.
Chapter 3 "I am Willie Buckhuber," the stranger says. God bless him. Why did that make me grateful? Because he did not say he was William Buck or Billy Hubert. That is, he was in no way like my father-in-law, Herr Daniel Bobst, who lived his days in terror of being thought a kraut. Dan had changed Bobst to Bobs, then acted out his airman nonsense as if he had really served the King of England. When he retired to his scrapyard, he reinforced this false impression, filling it with bomb casings and other materiel from war disposal. But Dan was gone from our lives now, together with his belief that his son was put on earth to do his bidding. I had not taken an Aspro in a month, and I knew the reason. No Dan. No more. Titch was finally his own man, at work pacing out the shed, and he was understanding that it was true what I had told him. We could put 3 vehicles there. I loved so much to see him happy. The autumn air was sweet with burning leaves. There was a white chook fossicking for worms. I didn't even wonder how it got there. White chook, green grass, blue sky. My Edith had said goodbye to her last boarding house meal. She had found canna lilies growing wild behind the laundry. Ronnie dug up a wet and slippery tennis ball, with which he accidentally hit the neighbour. Mr. Buckhuber had a colander in his right hand, but he caught the ball on the rebound off his chest. The colander contained a cauliflower and teetering eggs, but he lobbed the ball gently back in the direction of my son, who had already run away and was tracking a rusty-coloured hen through unmown grass. I slipped my spanner into my pocket. Edith jumped at Ronnie's chook, and the chook flew into the air. Whoever heard of such a thing? A hen with wings like a mighty eagle's. It landed on the tin roof of our house. You had to laugh. "Sorry," said the neighbour, and I understood the chook was his. "Buckhuber," he repeated, reminding me I hadn't said my name. "We are Bobs," I told him, nodding to my husband who was attending to our vehicle with his Belgian feather duster. "Blind to everything but cars," I said. He could not help himself, dear Titchy. His vehicles must be clean. He could travel the dustiest road to the loneliest farm, and he would always find a creek before he arrived, and he would have a chamois and a bucket and roll his sleeves up. He presented his vehicles in the filthiest situations, always in showroom condition like himself. The neighbour was tall and whippy with slender arms. He had not yet explained the colander, and I did not like to presume it was for us. But he was a nice-looking man with fine fair hair he had to flick away. He had the most spectacular frown, which pushed down around his schnoz. It made you want to comfort him some way. He said, "Perhaps I can carry this inside for you." He meant the colander, and I followed him inside, trying to remember where I had packed the Kraft Cheddar. It was a Sunday. All the shops were closed. The house was a shambles and a pigsty, and the movers had left the hydraulic jack in the hall and the kitchen table in the living room. There was a hole kicked in the bedroom plaster I hadn't noticed when I took the place. Only now did I learn that the oven was coated with rancid grease. I turned on the gas range, but it would not light. I tried a dozen matches and burned my finger on the last one before I accepted that the gas was not connected. Meanwhile, the neighbour had vanished. Embarrassed for me, probably, but we would get our domestic situation into shape. The hydraulic jack was 6 feet long, weighed a ton, but I wheeled it out to the back door and across the threshold and down the garden path. Finally, the gravel stopped all further movement. Ronnie had commandeered next door's colander and was gathering eggs from amongst the canna lilies. The neighbour was standing at the fence again. He raised his eyebrows, perhaps referring to the tea towel on his shoulder. He was a comic turn, but not too much, I hoped. I had no heat to cook with, but we had bread, and I knew we had cheese and some apples. I was so light and happy to be just us four. Then I heard the crunch of tires on gravel, and saw, entering our establishment, a 1938 Plymouth, equipped with one of those wood-burning gas producers from the days of wartime petrol rationing. This one had a large cylindrical furnace. From this, a pipe snaked across the roof and then down into the engine. Who would drive a thing like this in 1953? As the window in the driver's door descended slowly, the vehicle cut rudely in front of me, laying white oil smoke across the yard. My father-in-law was on the graveyard side of 70, but he stepped into our yard clad in the usual cotton dust coat, full of piss and vinegar. How had he tracked us down? He released a statuesque biddy in furs and high-heeled shoes. That must be Mrs. Donaldson. Ignorant, I thought, seeing how she gave the kiddies barley sugar. No one had invited Mr. Buckhuber, but he was standing on the Plymouth's running board, inspecting the dog's breakfast on the roof, amongst which, it seems, he had identified an old aircraft propeller. "Westland Wallace," he pronounced, as if I should applaud. Both kids took my hand, dear babies. The neighbour closed his eyes and spoke without invitation. "Mr. Dan Bobst, having engine trouble with his Westland Wallace, negotiated a clever landing by the Jeremond station, then transferred to his Malvern Star bicycle, by which means he travelled 4 miles to Orbost for emergency supplies." He was like a clever child reciting poetry. A look of cunning twisted my father-in-law's features. He grabbed for something in his trouser pocket, a business card which he would snatch back when it had served its purpose. The card would be green and faded. On it would be printed the likeness of the Westland Wallace, which had appeared in the British Empire Trade Exhibition in Buenos Aires. Above this image, in the washed-out sky, would be a moustached aviator in leather helmet and goggles. "Dangerous Dan Bobs, the oldest airman in the world." "Thank you, Mr. Bobs," said Mr. Buckhuber. I was upset to see how reverently he held the card. "But I do know exactly who you are." But who could ever imagine the size of Dan Bob's self-regard? A mood descended on me very bad indeed. "A clever landing by the Jeremond station, then transferred to his ever-present bicycle, by which means he travelled 4 miles to Orbost. Where..." Ronnie squeezed my hand and looked up at me, all teeth and worried eyes. "He purchased a bar of soap needed to repair the leaking petrol line." You might expect Dan to be interested in how a total stranger could have this write-up off by heart, but curiosity was not his strong point. He puffed himself up like a cobra, glaring in triumph at those of us whose wallets he planned to lighten. "I should like to introduce my colleague, Mrs. Donaldson," he said. As the housekeeper stepped forward, Titch removed a box from the boot of the Ford and escaped with it towards the house. Dan and his female colleague hardly noticed. They were all over Buck Hooper, as if he were a feed of steak and kidney pudding.
"You in the motor game?" Dan asked.
"No, no, nothing so interesting."
I interrupted, but it was as if a dog spoke, the way they both looked at me.
"The propeller is a real beauty," I said.
"Talk to your husband,"
he said, but I was the one who must refuse this gift. I smiled and grovelled and wagged my tail. I told him I wished we could afford it, that we had no place to even store it. I made myself feel sick.
"It would be a crime," I said, "to expose it to the weather."
Dan turned away to Buck Hooper.
"What sort of vehicle do you have yourself?"
"Just a bike,"
said Buck Hooper.
"A Melvin Star."
Dangerous Dan then announced he had personally known Sir Hubert Opperman. Oppie had ridden a Malvern Star to win the famous Paris-Brest-Paris race.
"In 1931, added the neighbour.
This unsettled Dan.
"I was a mate of Tom Finnegan. You ever heard of him?"
"My word," said Buck Hooper.
"Mr. Malvern Star himself. Began business in Glenferrie Road."
"Yes, number 58.
Dan began searching urgently inside his wallet. Then he changed his mind.
"Go get your bike," he ordered. "Let's see.
It's just an old crate."
"You won't be sorry, Buck Hooper."
And off the innocent went, still carrying his tea towel, marching over the fallen autumn leaves, up the driveway to the street. There were bloody chooks lined up on the ridge line of the house.
"Dad," I said.
"Keep your panties on, geez.
We're broke, Dad."
Mrs. Donaldson urgently produced more sweets, fancy chocolates from Daryl Lee. I had to take them.
"You're not setting up a pitch here," said Dan.
He was on the running board, his back towards me, releasing his white elephant.
"You haven't got a hoist. You haven't even got a petrol pump. You should have told me."
"We wouldn't ask you for money," I said. "You've got trouble of your own." That got his full attention.
"What trouble?"
He swung on me.
"I've got no bloody troubles. I'm not like some people. I'm not going into business with no experience. I'm not sneaking off to go into competition with my father."
"You said you were retired."
"You shouldn't be so secretive," he said.
"We didn't have your number."
"The boy imagines he can be a Ford dealer with a place like this. With 5 quid in the bank, does no one have a clue? You think I don't still talk to the blokes at Ford?"
"They're assessing the application now. We filled it out."
"You just embarrassed them," Dan said.
"Call off your dog, Dan," they said.
"Don't call your son a dog."
That was the wrong way to speak to Dan, but fortunately Buck Hooper came back with his bicycle, and all the interest went that way.
"I like bikes,"
he announced, winding rope around his arm.
"By Jove, yes. I had a bike myself."
"Yes,"
the poor fellow recited.
"You carried a Melvin Star bicycle on your plane." "No, listen."
The neighbour smiled agreeably.
"I'd give you 40 quid for the bike. I could tip you into a Ford custom line exactly like that one there. How's that? I'm not so far away. Any problems, I can be here in a mo."
"Yes, but I've brought something for you, Mr. Bobs."
The neighbour had a beautiful old book in the basket. There was a gold picture of an old plane on its cover, and a title like Aeronautics, except in some foreign language. Of course Dan wanted it, but he stepped back, holding up his hands.
"I could go as high as 50 for the bike,"
he said. The neighbor held the book like a Bible to his chest.
I can't drive. I'll teach you. I'm okay. Are you?
Dan asked, and I recognized that nasty edge.
What do you do for a crust? I'm a school teacher.
That was when Dan lost interest. I'd seen him do this so many times before. He climbed to the running board and untied the final rope. He lifted the propeller free, and with a grunt pivoted, and compelled the poor bloke to accept it.
You what? School teacher.
Mr. Buckhuber was forced to kneel in order to set the propeller on the grass. He pointed out that it had been sheathed in copper, which had once been secured by either screws or rivets, soldered, and then expertly smoothed down.
Lovely work.
Dan hid his smile behind his hand, an offensive gesture, there for all the world to see.
A chalk and talker. That's me. Are these your chooks on the roof? I'm afraid so, yes. You can't have them making their mess here. Not now they're a little kiddies. Their mother will tell you, won't you, Mumsy? It's not hygienic. You kept chooks before? No. The trick is, mate, you need to clip their wings. Yes, I didn't get around to it. Any mug can do it. All we need is some clippers, which actually I have.
When I protested, he turned his hate on me.
Are you a mother or what?
I heard the back door bang. Titch returned, not knowing I had lit a fire. I had promised I would never again fight Dan, but now I didn't care. If Mr. Buckhuber needs help with his chickens, I said, I'll be happy to assist.
You can clip wings.
I smiled right in his nasty face.
Dad, Titch said, I'm sorry, but we can't use the prop.
This was a first. I could have cried.
You need some signage, sonny. You can be a Ford dealer all you like. No one will notice. The prop is what they call sales promotion. I can't afford it, Titch said. £15? Of course you can afford it. You want people to know you're in business, don't you? You want the town to talk about you. Even if the council makes you take it down, just dig a hole in the front lawn.
Your dad says his mates at Ford have rejected our application.
You shouldn't have gone behind my back to Ford, Dan said. You're an embarrassment. You think they'll give you a Ford dealership, a place like this?
Titch's colour had risen, but his smile was crisp and neat.
We'll help you tie it on again.
Then he lifted the propeller, and I thought, you lovely man. Dan nodded to Mrs. D. Immediately she turned, and with a small apologetic smile to me, teetered across the gravel to the car. A moment later, the Plymouth accelerated up the drive. The propeller dwarfed my husband and seemed to overpower him, but no, he lifted it like a barbell and hurled it against the fence.
£15,
he cried. Our neighbour's mouth was open.
Thank God I was not born a strong man, my husband said, or I would have killed someone by now.
Chapter 4. As a baby in the Pineham Parsonage, I had climbed up to the kitchen sink and tumbled out the window where, by sheer good fortune, I gouged a lump from beneath my shoulder blade and left my little head intact. Sometimes in later years, in the shower, for instance, I would explore the crater in my flesh and amuse myself by thinking of what it prophesied. A lifetime of escaping my own dull nature, of seeking the thrill of energy by jumping when I should be safe and still. It was this desire, I'm now certain, that physically attracted me to Adelina Koenig, That tall, dark beauty with whom I had cut my high school classes and explored the musty mud and grasses by the River Torrens, where it lived its sulky, sullen life at what was still called Pineham then. I was a pastor's son with no interest in money. I was not excited by the Koenig's wealth or status in the Deutsche Club, but to be in Adelina's presence was like being plugged into a PowerPoint, like becoming her subject, as vitally connected as an electric fan or drill. Mrs. Bobsey was the same. Her husband had pink cheeks, jet-black hair, an unworldly vitality that made you think of the circus. How I envied him his life. Mrs. Bobsey struck matches, and her failures were exhilarating. I had a week's worth of stew to offer, 7 single meals for each inevitable night, just waiting in the fridge. My thoughts were on the mad side, obviously. At home, I put the dinner on my stove, removed books from my dining room table, replaced them with others. I doubted my personal library would be of much interest to this family, but I also knew there were volumes anyone would love. French, mostly, but illustrated with fine engravings. The beauty of the mechanical age. Knitting machines. Automata. Aeroplanes with feathers on their wings. It was to my advantage there was no market for that language in my monolingual land. Mrs. Bobsey didn't like her father-in-law. I could have listened to him all day. If he tried to sell me a car, why would I mind? Given a chance, I would have paid for the propeller. I could have hung it from the ceiling on the diagonal suspended by piano wire. At the same time, I was thrilled to see tiny, shiny Mr. Bobsey hurl the valuable item against the fence. What different lives they lived to mine, clipping chook wings, repairing aeroplanes with soap, deciding to be Ford dealers, asking no one permission, alone, like tightrope walkers, with no summonses to hide from. I would have given everything to be like them. What would Dangerous Dan have done about the summons? Would he pay support for a child that was not his? Would he endure the double insult of being laughed at as a cuckold as well as suffering the relentless punishment of paying for the fruit of adultery? I was not sorry to have removed myself from Adelina's world, but I was ashamed to have fled like a worm. I had crawled from the State Library of Victoria, where I had been wonderfully at home, and slunk to Bacchus Marsh, where the high school was desperate to let me teach the worst class in the school. Legal letters sought me, care of Mr. Deasy's quiz show, but Deasy had much invested in me, and for this reason we always pre-recorded at erratic times. The bailiffs arrived when the show was on air, and I was far away. When you understand the deceitful nature of the quiz show prizes, those huge checks as big as a door which Deasy presented in public, you will bet he must have dodged a bailiff once or twice himself. By the simple expedient of not reading my mail or answering my own door, I had been safe until I hung young Bennett Ash by his ankles out the classroom window. What would happen now? Would the disciplinary tribunal treat me as my father's church did pregnant girls, demanding they stand before the congregation? Do you, Adelina Koenig, confess that you have manifestly sinned against God and given offence to his congregation? Do you pray that God, for Christ's sake, will forgive your sin, and do you also ask the congregation to forgive you? Do you also intend to amend your life and, by the help of the Holy Spirit, live according to God's will? Or will you just run away and not tell anyone your trouble? Bacchus Marsh High School was a 2-story red-brick building in approximate Edwardian style, separated from the Mattingly Oval by a 2-lane road, along which the 5-ton colliery trucks, having spilled a little of their load on the railway crossing, accelerated on their way to... no one knew exactly where. I had already broken my father's decent heart. Had he stood across this busy road on a certain afternoon in the early autumn of 1953, he would have been destroyed to learn that it was me, his beloved son, who was responsible for the bawling 13-year-old hanging from the second-story window. I was sorry. I am always sorry. I had arrived in Bacchus Marsh 4 years and 3 months previously. I seemed to have no wife or even girlfriend. My name was obviously German, but I was not, as far as anyone could see, a sissy. In my first year I played on the wing for Bacchus Marsh, where the Express reported me to be fast and slippery as an eel. Then Butch Daly called me a kraut. My name was Bachhuber. Take a joke, they said. I smiled, and was as misunderstood as I had wished to be. Soon I got a hamstring injury. That seemed the only safe response. And that is the creature I had spent my life becoming. I was so expert at avoiding conflict that it still seems impossible that I was brought down by a child. The second form of the high school had been, until my arrival, a notorious scene of rage and uproar, a simmering pot ruled by boys who had been yearly denied promotion to the third form and were now in limbo, waiting for the day on which they could legally abandon their education. I turned 14 and you can't fucking touch me. I had a degree, but no teacher training. To my surprise, I was a successful teacher of the untouchables. The headmaster was grateful, but what my amiable colleagues secretly thought of me, I can never really know. The education department inspectors, however, loved me. A very good teacher working earnestly and zealously in a challenging environment. So I had never expected to be vulnerable to Bennett Ash, who I'd long ago brought to heel. Bennett had dirt ingrained on his skinny wrists and lice eggs, doubtless, beneath his broken nails. It was Bennett, sitting in the front row where I kept him, who accused me of having bolts in the class. Where would one start? I asked him what he thought a bolt was. He thought it was a refo, sir. He meant refugee, a person displaced by war. I could have escorted him to the map of the world, that is, the pink British Empire, and the other bits. I could have shown him that bolt was short for Baltic, or a person from the Baltic States. But could he even recognize the Baltic Sea? How could I possibly teach him that the Australian government had deliberately misnamed the displaced person's bolts? That was the path by which the word had entered his vocabulary. How many weeks might it take to have him understand that the Australian government was selecting light-skinned, Nordic types as future citizens, and that they had, for the sake of obfuscation, named them bolts? Of course, I had my own ancient scars and fears, my deep sense of displacement, that I was not from here, that this was not my landscape, that I had been denied my natural land, which had been accurately depicted by Caspar David Friedrich. I asked Bennett, did he know what a Nordic type was? You never taught us, sir. Then sit down. Put your hanky back in your pocket. Then Susie Winspear, whose father was a dentist with a slow, old-fashioned drill, said that Sipper van Hanrad was a Nordic type. Sipper, in the second row, was actually Dutch. He was tall, with fine blonde hair, and was quickly beginning to grasp the lessons. Yes, said Bennett Ash, holding up a warty hand. Sipper is a bolt, sir. You favour him. His point was that Sipper's hair was pretty much like mine. Yes, Bennett, what is a bolt? What about you, sir? Why did they let you in? I am a calm man, have been so all my life. I grabbed the heel of the boy's hobnailed boot and yanked him off balance and pushed his body out the window and held him there while he bawled and shouted. He was not a big boy, but he had mass. He squirmed and flapped, and I felt the horror of my relentless dreams, which were peopled not only by snakes, but creatures like possums that would end up being born as children if I did not kill them. The rivers in my sleep were filled with fish which broke apart like wet cardboard. I often sleepwalked, but in my classroom I was wide awake, dangling a pupil out my window. There was no precedent for this except the unexpected fit that had me leave my marriage. It would later be alleged that I had refused to haul Bennett Ash back to safety until he promised not to breed. This was never true. Once he was safe, I gave dictation just to calm the situation. Anyone can now tell me I had ignored a valuable teaching moment, but Bennett lived in a world where the truth would die of thirst. I had been a peaceful, much-loved child with a great passion for atlases, but there would be no such thing, even of the musty, cheaply printed variety, in the shadow of the condensed milk factory where Bennett Ash lived. Nor would anyone in that dark place discuss, in terms high or low, the government's thoughts on non-British migration into monocultural Australia. No one would care what Nordic or Baltic meant, or see the parallels between the government's recruitment of Nordic types and their habit of removing the paler Aboriginal children from their mothers and giving them to white families with the total confidence that half-castes would never give birth to throwbacks. Wishful racial thinking with no basis in genetics. The headmaster didn't visit me until after the final bell, when I found him blocking my exit, posing, I thought, running a large index finger along the disturbing vein in the pale eggshell head that I would see again much later in the work of George Gross. "You know, a lot of idiots will be pleased to hear what you did." I suppose I must have sighed. If not, I irritated him another way. "You do know that, don't you, Willie? The whole marsh will be talking about it now." "Yes, they'll love it," said Harry Huffnance, biting off the words while continuing to smile. "They'll say the boy deserved it, but none of them has my job." "Sorry, Harry. There's a social worker involved with the Ash family. Did you know that? She'll want to advocate for her client." "Client? It's not funny. Yes, Bennett is her client. She'll want to address our disciplinary tribunal." "Harry, don't do this." "Willie, I don't have a choice. You didn't give me one." "Perhaps I could have a chat to the dad." "You will not go near that family. Luckily, I have a little influence with the tribunal." I had no way of knowing if this was true, but Huffnance surely wouldn't want to lose a teacher who could actually handle the second form boys. My predecessor had punched him in the nose before departure. "I'll have to suspend you, Will." "Oh, please don't frown like that." "With pay?" He gave me a sharp look, and I knew what he was thinking. "Buck Huber is rich. He gets those big prizes from his quiz show. You wouldn't believe the bloody paperwork involved in a tribunal." "What sort of suspension is it?" "Maybe you could think about the wool syllabus while you're off." It was typical that he should wish to trade with me. The wool syllabus was his chore, not mine. It was bureaucratic, not pedagogic. He had been directed to remedy the total ignorance of high school students on the issue of wool and its vital role in the history of the state. The source of this correspondence was the State Education Department in Melbourne. But what political forces were behind this aberration? Who would know? "It's rubbish," I told him. "You said so yourself. This is more your sort of thing, Harry." "Well, if you remain on the payroll, you must do something. You'll make something of it, I know you will. You can design this better than anyone else in the school, certainly better than me." "You'll only rewrite it afterwards." "I won't have the time. You have my word. You'll give me time to concentrate on the tribunal. Come on, give me a break. Full pay, okay?" He was disgusted by my imagined greed. I couldn't really blame him. He was not privy to the value of all Deasy's phony checks. He straightened up and buttoned his shiny suit and held out his damp hand. "I can save your bacon. You have my word." He was weak, and his word was worthless, and I didn't believe him for a second. So why was it that I rode home in such a strange, light mood? Was I finally in that state Sebastian Lasky had spoken of? Was I now empty of myself, formless like water? Was it possible that I was happy to have once again destroyed my scaffolding, to be hanging from another window, tremulous and giddy, on the brink of my real life?
Chapter 5. I had relinquished our children to one more foreign school, but all I could think about was that damn propeller. Clearly, I was not a normal mother. And yet the propeller was a danger to us all, not least because someone had woken in the middle of the night and dragged the damn thing inside the shed. Was I meant to think it walked in there? Had it been transported there by elves? Or was my husband still his father's slave? "Out of the weather," Titch said, and looked at me with his mouth wobbly. "Out of the bloody weather? Why had we carted our kids 100 miles from anything they knew? Not to see their father carrying Dan's propeller like the Holy Cross. I loved Titch, of course I did, but we were not returning to our former servitude. I've a mind to dump it up the tip," I said. In reply, he kissed my hand, and I saw he would let my temper run its course. "Like a grass fire by the road," he would have said. "Very bloody funny, ha ha. But not all grass fires stay by the verge, as is well known. They can rage for miles, for acres, destroying all the fences as they go, all the way from the marsh to Mordialloc, to burn a certain scrapyard to the ground." My father-in-law had owned stables and taxi services, and had maybe sold a lot of Fords, but he had never been within spitting distance of a franchise. His mates at Ford would drink with him and listen to his airman stories, but he was an artful dodger and would go to the grave without ever being an authorized dealer in anything. At 75 years of age, he was still in competition with his son. Dan worshipped Henry Ford to an extreme degree. Titch had the same disease. He was therefore happy to let the Ford Motor Company go snooping through our bank account, our debts, our credit history. And now, while they were deciding if we were good enough to be their authorized dealer, while there were no new vehicles released to us, Titch would take the train to Ballarat to buy used stock from Joe Thacker. You would fear for Titch to see him walk into the pub that Joe Thacker called my office. All those windburnt faces, cow cockies, racecourse touts, bookmakers, cockroaches living off the smell of spilled beer and last night's cigarettes. I only saw it once, and I thought he would be killed in there, my Titchy. He was too small, too neat, and his shoes were far too dainty. But as I was compelled to accept and understand, he was at home in Craig's Hotel. He was a strange and unexpected creature, unlike anything you could imagine, controlled and well-dressed, then like a crazy little animal when the lights were off. No one would believe it, if they ever knew, or heard, good grief. His mouth. So I drove him to the station and parked the car, and walked hand in hand to the platform, and I wrapped his tartan scarf around his neck, and buttoned it inside his camel overcoat. I kissed him. He kissed me. It was perhaps not the best occasion to say what I said, but I said it anyhow. We should not wait for Ford's approval. We were better off without them. We had arrived in the era of Australia's own car, i.e. General Motors Holden. It was now Holden versus Ford, and Ford was set to lose. We should tell Ford to jump in the lake, snaffle the Bacchus Marsh Holden dealership while it was still available. Titch listened to my blasphemy. He did not ask how I could be so confident of getting a Holden dealership. He said he would think about what I had said, but clearly he couldn't wait to get away from my opinions. He kissed my eyes and said he loved me, but he was hurt to be called a nervous Nelly. He boarded the train. I drove first to the co-op, and then the butcher's, where they tried to find out who I was. They were very eager to deliver, but I wouldn't give them the address. Everybody wants to know your private business. I drove home and straight into the shed, and there was the copper-tipped propeller catching the light like some disgusting Catholic saint. I had not really intended to dump it on the tip, today or ever, but now I ran inside and snatched the eiderdown off our marriage bed and returned to the shed where I tied it across the roof of the custom line.